Good morning. So, last time we talked about another technique for doing cache timing attacks, where you wanted to observe what some other program was doing by virtue of the fact we shared some cache with them. And one strategy we talked about was this prime first probe idea, where the prime step is the attacker filled some specified cache sets with its data, then it let the victim program run and use some cache sets. And we mentioned that you could figure out which set cache sets were used by examining the speed of accessing that data you filled in earlier. And if the attacker is doing something with where the locations they're accessing depend on some information you're not supposed to know, well, this gives you a way of discovering it, even though you don't actually have direct access to that data. So talked about very briefly about cache coherency. So one issue we have with multi-core machines, where we have multiple cores, each of which has their own cache because they're accessing different things, you want to have the data they're accessing close by, is that they can have inconsistent versions of data. And we talked about two solutions. One solution is that we invalidate all the other copies when we modify one of the versions. Another is we update all the other copies. We glossed over all the details about how this works. So if we can invalidate the other copies, we have to figure out where are they. We have to communicate that. So there's a bunch of stuff you learn in a more advanced class about those details and how we make this efficient. How we make it so we don't actually need to talk to all our processors on every single write. But we learned from this that, we have some mechanism for invalidating particular things in the cache. And it turns out on Intel processors, we have a more direct way of doing this. We don't have to try to write to it. We can use this special CL flush, cache line flush instruction, provided we have access to that address. And this gets to another cache timing attack, where if we have a shared array, if somehow we have access to the secret data being accessed, for example, maybe there's a lookup table and we're passing something secret to it, like we're looking up a secret string to convert it to uppercase in a table of here's the uppercase version of all the characters, then we can flush that out of the cache, let the victim access part of that, and measure the speed of accessing it to see was it used after we invalidated it or not. If it was used, then if we share a cache, it's going to be in that shared cache, even though we invalidated it earlier because the victim program used it. Then we talked about our first topic for today, which is data level parallelism. In contrast to instruction level parallelism, we'll have one instruction that does multiple things on the same data. So we'll have hardware support for this. So one piece of hardware support is we'll have these wider registers for holding arrays of values, known as vectors. And to act on those registers, we'll have these multi-lane ALUs, these ALUs which can perform multiple operations at once on separate, what are called lanes, which are basically elements of the arrays that are the inputs, the array registers that are the inputs. And the big advantage of this is we can do more operations per cycle without much extra control logic. When we were talking about making our processors wider, we needed to add extra control logic to make the instruction queue bigger and do all the forwarding. Here, we aren't adding much of that extra control logic, and we're still getting more operations done per cycle, provided that someone writes instructions that do use these vector registers. And we said, sometimes compilers can do this automatically, but it turns out that it's pretty challenging. And if you try to use compilers, and with settings which are supposed to generate vector instructions, sometimes you'll be very happy. Sometimes the compiler will generate this great code that goes really fast. And sometimes you'll be like, what's wrong? What's wrong? Obviously, you can use vector registers for this. Why aren't you doing that? So it's not very consistent, and if you take a compiler's course, they might go into more detail about why it's hard to do. But we mentioned there was an alternative way, which is that we can use these things called intrinsics to help the compiler know, yeah, I really want to use these vector registers and instructions. Here's exactly how to do it, rather than expecting the compiler to figure it out itself. So before we move on and go through an example of what those look like, any questions on anything that was covered last time? Okay, so first I'll go through probably the simplest use case I can think of for these vector instructions. So here I'm going to take this code, which is basically the example we had last time, and I'm going to turn it into using something that uses vector instructions using those compiler hints in case the compiler couldn't figure it out. In practice, if you set the optimization settings correctly with the compiler, most compilers can figure this case out, but not some of the more complicated ones. But I'll start with something simple here. Where here I have, I'm adding this array of ints, a to b into a. So in order to turn this into vector instructions, first I want to say, well, I'm going to want to use this instruction, which adds a whole bunch of elements of a and a whole bunch of elements of b at once, pairwise and parallel. So to make it easier to think of how that's going to work, first I'm going to unroll the loop, and I'm going to expose this operation I want to done in parallel. And I know that there's this SIMDAdd instruction, which does all these adds all in one instruction. And conveniently, just unrolling the loop exposes them as each loop iteration should turn into that one instruction. So what I ultimately want to generate is going to be something like this. This is the assembly I want the compiler to generate for this. It's something like, this is load into one of these vector registers, a part of A and a part of B, where REX is the index as a byte number of bytes. Then do the add. The add instruction has this funny name because it's a vector add of what are called double words. That's what the D is for. It's not intuitive. We're not going to have you memorize them, but they have different names for the different widths. And then we move the result back into our destination register, for which I meant to write A of RAX, but something here. And keep going, do our loop operation, increment our index, our byte index by 32 bytes, because it turns out this instruction works 32 bytes at a time, does 32 bytes of ints, that's 8 ints at a time, just like my unrolled loop here. So more visually, this is what's happening. We're going to, each iteration of the loop, we're going to load a piece of B and a piece of A with this move instruction into one of these vector registers. We're going to use this vector add instruction to add all those pairs together to get our result into a vector register. And then we're going to store that result back into A with another move instruction. Okay, so questions? That does. So we're going to talk about using intrinsics for this. So we're going to have an intrinsic function, so something which looks like a C function call, to represent each of these assembly operations. And for some reason, Intel decided to have different opaque naming conventions for their instructions and for their intrinsics, neither of which are very good names. So I'm sorry about that, but that's just what Intel chose, and we're working on Intel machines, so we're going to use the names they chose for better or worse. So here's the explicit intrinsic-based version of that loop. So again, I've already unrolled this loop, so I'm doing 8 elements at a time because that's the size of my add instruction. And one thing is I'm going to explicitly tell my compiler, these are the things I want in these vector registers. So I'm going to have these 256-bit type. In this case, I'm using 256i, which means 256 bits of some type of integers. There's some other types for floats or doubles, but they're all just 256 bits. You can cast between them, and you're just, you know, reinterpreting that 256 bits of data as something else. So I have these intrinsic functions which represent the move instructions. So I have a load and a store, and these represent load is a move from memory, store is a move into memory. And these have some funny names. So we have this SI256 that says 256 bits of integers, probably signed. And the U on the load represents unaligned. If you don't put the U in there, there's another version of the instruction which assumes that the address you supply is a multiple of 32 bytes, which probably you don't want to do, but because you don't actually know exactly what address A is at. And similarly with our store. And we have this add instruction that we represent with this function, and the EPI32 means 32-bit integers. And in this case, 8 32-bit integers. And we can also do this with different sizes. So Intel has an instruction to add a bunch of 32-bit integers. They also have, if you pardon the error up here, an instruction to add a bunch of 64-bit integers, which means we could do the same code but with four elements at a time, but just changing the add instruction to be adding not 32-bit integers but 64-bit integer pairs using, in this case, have my highlighting wrong, a law arrays of logs. But this is the version we're going to focus on. So what we get is we have each of our instructions represented by one of these special functions. We have variables which represent things that go in those vector registers, and that's, you know, sort of how we translated that to something where we told the compiler what to do. But fortunately, it wasn't as bad as writing assembly, because we didn't have to deal with all the loop indexing stuff and all that, at least. And the compiler figured out what registers to use for all our variables. If we had more variables, we wouldn't have to figure all that out. So this is hopefully sort of in between the difficulty of writing the assembly code I showed you directly and relying on the compiler to do everything. So more questions? Okay. So that's what that looks like. So also, this will come up when you look at documentation, that there are, also 128-bit versions of all these things, because the history was in 1999, Intel introduced 128-bit vector stuff, and then they made them wider so they could do more at a time. And they changed the name of everything. So 256 becomes 128, so that makes sense. But in the names of the intrinsics, there should not be an extra underscore here, the 256 just goes away because history, not because it makes sense. But if you ever need to know what to use, just look them up. Don't bother memorizing them. I certainly do not. And in the lab we have on Wednesday, we have point to a reference we've written which has most of the ones you should need, and we also point to the official reference from Intel. Yes?
In the file, we don't need to know any
of the syntax, right? You don't need to know, we will tell you the operators you need. Memorizing these names would be silly. Yeah? There will be a mix of questions. So. Okay, so let me go through another example to show a trickier case to use these vector instructions. So the add is fairly straightforward because, well, we have an instruction which adds eight things. It corresponds very directly to what you're doing. But often we want to use these vector instructions for things where the correspondence is not so clear. So here I have an example of a matrix multiply. And this is my simple matrix multiply. I'm not doing some things I should do for performance, like cache blocking and a few other things. I'm not using temporaries to tell the compiler that, hey, A, B, and C don't overlap, so really you can take advantage of that. So there's a bunch of things I'm not doing that are other optimizations. I'm going to talk about how do you make this use vector instructions. So first I'm going to do the same step I did before. This is a matrix of ints, so I know my 256-bit vectors can store 8 of them, so I'm going to unroll the inner loop 8 times. And my goal is to do these operations with vector instructions, because I know I can do 8 things at a time, I can add 8 values at a time, I can multiply 8 values at a time. I want to take advantage of that. And here I have 8 multiplies to do that I should be able to do all at once, 8 adds to do that I should be able to do all at once, and also 8 loads and store, pairs, sets of 8 loads and stores I should be able to do all at once. So it looks like there's a case where I can use these vector instructions to do this. But there's a few complications. So one is that I didn't tell you how to do a multiply. Another is that, well, this doesn't fit our pattern anymore here. That this is not 8 values from an array, this is 1 value from an array repeated 8 times. So we need some way of dealing with that. And it's going to be very handy that there's an intrinsic, which corresponds almost directly to an instruction, which loads 1 value into 8 copies of it. Precisely because this sort of code is not actually pretty common. It's a pretty common operation, so they made it so that was easy to do with a few instructions. So this is probably going to turn into 2 instructions, it turns out. This function is equivalent to those 2 instructions, a move instruction and this broadcast instruction, which copies a value from one part of a vector to all the parts of a vector register. So that will load array copies, and we need to multiply. And the multiply intrinsic, you would expect, well, we're just going to replace add with mul. Well, it's mul low instead of mul. The idea is that the normal mul 1 multiplies 32-bit values to get a 64-bit value. So the mul low multiplies 32-bit values and only gives you the bottom 32 bits of those values, which is what we care about here, because we're getting a 32-bit result in our matrix. Okay, so questions so far? Yeah?
So, is unsigned int always 32 bits?
So this question is, unsigned int always 32 bits? Not everywhere, but on the machines we're using ints. And on the machines which will have these functions, yes. Okay, so I'm gonna vectorize this, and I'm gonna just go operation by operation. I'm not gonna write the code in order. So first I'm gonna say, well, I have this part of C that I'm reading and writing. So I know to read, I'm going to use this load. And I know I'm reading contiguous elements, 1 to 7. So I'm just going to load starting at 0. And that's going to load 256 bits there. So it's going to load element 0, 1, plus 1, plus 2, plus 3, plus 4. So it's going to load all 8 of those elements. And then later on, after I modify this vector value Cij, which remember holds 8 elements of C, I'm going to store it back where I loaded it from. And in the middle here, I'm going to have the code which actually does the plus equals operation. And similarly, I'm going to load a part of B. And conveniently, that's also contiguous. So I can conveniently do that. And I'm going to load a part of A and multiply it with that part of B. So to load this part of A, I'm only going to load 1 element, and I'm going to use that set1 operation, which loads 1 element and copies it into all the vectors. And it takes not a pointer, but just the integer to load, which I knew by looking it up, not by guessing. And then I'm going to use the multiply operation to get my multiply results. And I'm going to add that to C with the add instruction we saw earlier, that vector add, so that add, we have results for all 8 of these. We're going to add them to all 8 of the C values with one instruction. And then I'm going to store that result back in C. So questions about any of the things I did here? So this gives us this combined code. So this is how, you know, I took my matrix multiply and vectorized it, and we can combine this with all the other optimizations we've talked about, like cache blocking, loop unrolling, using multiple accumulators potentially. All these can combine with these vector instructions, but I'm just doing the vector instruction part. Here. Okay. So this is the basic procedure, and you'll notice that we needed some extra operations to deal with. Well, we couldn't actually load things and have them where we wanted. So there's some additional operations I want you to know exist for this. You should look up how they work, because I certainly do not memorize how they work. So for example, like sometimes you might load something into a vector from an array, but to do, when you look at the operations you want to do, it won't be j plus 0, j plus 1. It will be some other, like j plus 2, j plus 3, j plus 0, j plus 1, or something like that. There are instructions for doing this, which go by various names like shuffling or swizzling or permuting, that you can use to do that. You should look up what they do, but they exist. And this is kind of an unfortunate thing when you're doing this sort of vector instruction stuff you need to supply, right? Because things aren't always in the order you want. You need to mix values around. And when you're writing those sort of loops, that's more straightforward. You just access different array indices. Here, it's not so simple, because you need to move all the things at once. So for example, there's a permute operation to do that transformation, which takes this funny argument here, which encodes the indices I want things in. And in the instruction, that appears as a constant, and there's some hardware which handles interpreting that constant and doing the rearranging. And as I said, I would never look this up, but these operations exist, and that's something I would just want you to know in case you, if you want to rearrange values and you don't see like a set one operation, there's probably a way of doing it. In the worst case, you can like copy it to an array and rearrange that array and copy it back into vector registers. But obviously that's probably slower because it's not doing things in parallel. And something I'd just like to briefly note about it, because it comes up a little in the smooth assignment, is that the history where we had this 128-bit before kind of shows up a little bit in these operations, in that moving things from between different halves of the 256-bit registers is tricky, because Intel wanted them to be easy to implement with 128-bit ALU, just in case you didn't have the 256-bit one. Which is just unfortunate. Okay, so, and do I not have, I thought I had, I thought I had a different slide here, but anyways, so, okay, so that's our overview of intrinsics. So some just general notes on this. So you talked about intrinsics. There are other ways you might find out in the real world for accessing vector instructions. Most notably, GPUs. If you've heard about GPUs being nice and fast, the reason GPUs are fast are basically they just have lots of vector instructions. And there are some more flexible operations that are common on things like GPUs, which are actually quite old. Like these designs date back to the 90s. But you typically were specialized machines and not part of general purpose processors. And they support things that seem hard to do right now, like what if I want to load a whole bunch of memory addresses into my vector? Like those operations are common in other types of machines and kind of just barely appear in Intel's instructions, only on very new processors. And operations to write back values that way and so on. So and also handling conditionals, which seems very tricky. What if I want to add but only even elements? seems very tricky. There's more elegant ways of handling that that, you know, aren't part or weren't originally part of these sort of instructions Intel and other processor manufacturers were adding to general purpose processors. Okay, so questions on data level parallelism. Okay, so then I'm going to go on to our next topic, which is going to be about exceptions. And yes, I should have had a slide on what I just said, but I did not. So instead, exceptions. So here's, on a completely different topic, here's some code. It's my a nice program. So let's say I just run this on some shared like department machine that you can all log into. And let's say that machine only has one core. What's going to happen? I want to tell me what's going to happen. I run this on some shared machine. It only has one core. You're trying to use it too. Are you going to be able to use it? Yeah.
Because of multi-threading, you should still be able to access it.
Okay, so you say because of multi-threading. So let's say the machine only doesn't have hyper-threading. It has one core that runs one thread. Doesn't support multi-threading either. You think then can you still use the machine? So I agree. Yeah, for multi-threading, yeah, that solves the problem. What? No, you're. So who said you? Well, it turns out this is an experiment you could try, and the answer is yes, you could still use it, which is weird, right? Because there's nothing in this code which is letting you get a chance to use the machine, right? If you translate this to assembly, it's just an infinite loop. It just keeps running instructions forever. But something is happening that lets you use the machine, even if it's single core, single thread, despite that. We can examine this in more detail by instead of having like an infinite loop that does nothing, you get an infinite loop that just times something. So here I have some timing code. So I'm just starting a timer, ending a timer, checking the difference, and there's no instructions in between. It's just nothing. And we'd expect to get the same difference each time, roughly, modulo like the instruction cache warming up and so on. But after that happens, like we'd expect the same difference, like when we finish these instructions should be roughly the same each time. So we can check that. And if you run this code, so I ran this code on a machine I had access to, and here's a graph of the times I got. Note that it's a log scale on the left. So there's some outliers. And they're really huge outliers. Like typically, we're taking like a couple of nanoseconds, like 10, 15, 20 nanoseconds. And sometimes we're taking several milliseconds. So what do you think was happening on these outliers? Yeah. Yeah, so your proposal is something was letting other things run. And other things might be like other programs I was running on my machine while I was running this test. So those things were running and probably also running in these like shorter delays. So there's some mechanism, which despite the fact that this code has no way of executing those other programs. And the assembly also would have no way of doing that. It's just going to call this getTime function, whatever that does, and call it again. Now, something else gets executed. And this is an idea known as time multiplexing, that as an operating system, you know, we don't have an infinite number of CPUs, but we'd like to let everyone think they own the CPU. You know, all the CPUs they have, and we want to run more programs than that. So we need to divide up time on the CPUs we have. And so what this looks like to a program is I'm running my infinite loop, and I'm, you know, doing whatever I'm doing. I, you know, call my getTime function, save the results. And from my point of view, the processor is just a little weird. It has this million cycle stall for some reason. You know, that's my view, is that there's this million cycle stall and I keep running. You know, I'm still just, it looks like I'm the only one running, just that my processor has this weird slowness. And what's really happening is somehow other programs are getting to run, you know, like my SSH client or my web browser are getting to run during that, what looks to me, as from the loops program point of view, like a million cycle stall. And there has to be some hardware mechanism to enable that, and that's what we're going to talk about today. And that hardware mechanism is known as an exception. So the operating system runs in between, to switch between these programs, and something known as an exception is a hardware mechanism to start running the operating system. And the operating system then returns, as I said, call from that exception, and sets it up so when it does that, a different program is running. And that's how we're achieving this time multiplexing. So we have this hardware mechanism to start running instead of a normal program, even though the normal program doesn't have any instructions saying to do that. Yeah. So the question is this called context switching? So the operation that's occurring in each of these little blocks of OS time is called a context switch, which we'll talk about next. So the OS starts running instead of a different program. And when it does that, it's going to save where that program was. So it needs to know what the old program counter was and all its registers. It's going to set registers for the new program, jump to wherever that new program thinks it is, and do that. And this is called a context switch. It's called a context switch because the information we're saving, the old program counter and all the registers, is known as a context. So our context is basically all our registers, also a few other little details, like condition codes are part of the context, because if I don't save the condition codes, then that jump later on might not execute correctly. And there's something else part of the context we'll talk about later. So basically what our context switch is doing is this gets called, you know, from an exception. We have some special way of accessing what was the program counter before that exception happened. We need a special way because, well, when the OS starts running, the program counter is no longer in the program that was running. So something needs to remember that. And in fact, we're going to rely on the hardware as part of implementing exceptions, storing that information for the OS. Because otherwise, there's no way for the OS to know. And then the OS just copies the registers and then jumps to the new program. So like visually, we have our CPU stores the data for process A. It has its registers. It points to its memory. Then the OS is storing process B's context in its memory. And it basically just swaps what's in memory with what's on the CPU in order to start running a different program, loading a new program's registers into the CPU. So questions on this idea? Yeah?
I thought it was like single thread. Can we like differentiate what this context switching is doing versus like having multiple threads run on the same CPU?
Question is, can we differentiate this between having multiple threads run on the same CPU? So what each of these contexts that runs is known as a thread. But this is threading, which is supported only in software. So we might, in addition, have threading supported in hardware. The way that's typically going to appear to the OS is as if the OS has multiple cores on which it can run different programs at the same time. But on each of those cores, the OS is going to do still, on each of those fake cores, those hardware threads, the OS is still going to do this multiplexing most likely. Because the key thing is that the hardware only exposes so many sets of registers that the OS can fill. And it wants to have more of them. So it needs this mechanism to do that. Okay, other questions? It's a good question how this interacts with hardware threading. So that's one high level mystery about program. So here I have another sort of question about program. So here I have program A. I have a constant with the value 42 at address 10000 hex. And in program B, which I'm saying is running at the same time as program A, I'm going to copy 99 into there. What is program A going to read? Someone have a guess as to what's going to happen here. So I have these two programs, it's carefully written assembly, running at the same time, or is there some other problem, like I can't run these both at the same time, or something like that? Yeah?
So I thought we have more physical registers than what compilers see. Is that correct? So the RAX in program B might not be the same, or it mapped to a different register.
Okay, so your question is, how does what I showed you here interact with our physical register file being much bigger? So the OS is only dealing with architectural registers because it's running, like, to do this context switch, it's running move instructions. So those are going to deal with all the renamed registers. It's not going to know about the extra physical registers. So those aren't going to figure into our context switch. That's going to be hidden. We'll talk a little later about how this interacts with that more explicitly. But basically, the OS is only accessing the assembly visible registers. It's the only ones it knows about. It doesn't know about the extra registers the processor is using to implement these things. So we don't have, because of that, because the OS is moving into RAX normally when it's doing any context switching, we don't actually have to worry about RAX sort of being a different, secretly a different register. But we know that if program A runs and we switch to program B, we have a context switch. The OS is going to save RAX somewhere for A and load B's RAX, and going back, it's going to reverse that. Okay. So other thoughts on what's going to happen if I run these things at the same time, or if I can or can't do that? Yeah.
Shouldn't they have like different base addresses? That's just an offset.
So you're saying, shouldn't they have different base addresses that that's an offset from? So that is a mechanism that we could imagine. You're saying they should have independent memory, and you're saying the way that I think that should happen is we should just start them at different locations in memory. Like I'm kind of suggested with this picture that the programs have these different regions of memory. So that's a nice idea and is something that some machines do. It turns out that our mechanism for having independent memory is a little different than that. But the concept is right. When we run a program, if you have a pointer, you can't get pointers to other programs. And the way this works is going to work is that, you know, program A, well, it's always going to get 42. Program B is not going to change the value at that memory location in program A. That's not going to be allowed. And when program B accesses address 10,000, it's either going to get a crash or it's going to modify something which is not program A. So there's going to be some hardware support to make this happen, because these are just normal assembly instructions that are accessing a specific memory location. And we don't want to like copy everything to a particular memory location as part of our context switch. Because if you look at our times here, like we're spending like milliseconds. You can't copy that much memory in a, you know, less than a millisecond. So remember sort of our program memory. When we have two programs, well, it seems like their program memory overlaps. We have this sort of standard layout of memory where we put the stack at a particular place, we put our code at a particular place. It seems like we're going to run into a problem, and we need to fix that. So at this point, I'm going to talk about sort of a very high level of what the hardware support for this looks like. That we want to have these two programs, we want to have them to have separate memory. But think, you know, they have whatever memory layout is convenient. It's really nice that we know our stack is always up here and our code is always at the same place. We don't want to have to like worry about changing it each time our program runs. And the hardware mechanism for this is going to be that we're going to supply this notion of address spaces to programs. And we're going to do that by letting the operating system set this mapping that the hardware interprets. And this is going to be called virtual memory. We'll talk about after we talk about exceptions. where the program A's addresses go through this mapping in the hardware before they access the real memory. And program B's addresses do the same thing. And the OS can just make sure that this mapping doesn't let both either program access the same thing. So because this mapping is used, when I access address 10,000, well, it's going to go to here for program A and here for program B, so nothing bad's going to happen. They're just going to be modifying different parts of memory in actuality. Okay, so questions? So this mapping is also part of something you're probably familiar with, that you notice I have these like big holes. And this mapping is, well, why do we even have these holes? So part of this mapping is we can have some addresses which are set to, map to, trigger an error. And that's in fact going to use the same mechanism we talked about earlier, exceptions, to run the OS and say, hey, an error happened. This program accessed one of these things you told me via this mapping it wasn't supposed to. And you're probably familiar with what Linux does with that error, which is things which usually result in the message segmentation fault being printed out. Okay. So we have this mapping which determines what memory a program can access, and it includes having these holes in memory that the program cannot access. So this is called virtual memory, and that mapping has a particular name called a page table. And that's going to be an extra thing that's changed during a context switch. So we're not going to like copy memory around during a context switch, but we are going to change what the mapping is depending on what program we're running. Okay, and that's another part of our context. Even though you as a programmer can't directly observe what is the page table set to, you can just observe what memory can I access. So, questions about that idea? Okay. So when we put this address space and the time multiplexing idea together, we get what's known as a process. So a process, we have thread or multiple threads, and a thread is this illusion that you have your own CPU. My loop program ran as if it was the only thing on the CPU, just the CPU was weirdly slow. But I had all my own registers. I was never, I only noticed because I was timing things, but other than timing, like it looked like I had all those registers to myself, I could run all the instructions I wanted, and nothing else would happen. And the address space is the illusion that you have your own memory, that you can access memory, and your memory doesn't access other programs' memory, unless you've explicitly asked for that. And this together is what we call a process, and managing processes is most of what operating systems are built to do. Okay, so questions about this idea? Okay. So now that we've talked about this high-level process idea, we're going to talk more about exceptions, which we mentioned were the primary mechanism by which we implemented threads, this multiplexing, and also turned out were how we dealt with errors, like what happens when you access memory you're not supposed to. And there's also a few other kinds of exceptions. So I have a list here, and we have two broad categories of exceptions. So I have asynchronous exceptions. So these are exceptions where we start running the OS for reasons unrelated to what the current program is doing. So for example, in the case of my loop, the loop didn't do anything weird, like access invalid memory. Its instructions were perfectly normal, but we had something which caused the OS to run. And examples of these things are a timer. So there's typically a timer device the OS can set up that will run the OS after a certain amount of time. That's probably one thing which was causing other programs to run. Another example is I/O devices. When I press a key, we want the OS to figure out what program should handle that key press. And therefore, we want the OS to run, not whatever infinite loop program or whatever I'm running right now. So an exception is the mechanism where the processor lets the OS run and figure that out regardless of what's running now. So these are called asynchronous because they're not triggered by the running program. We don't care about the running program. We just want to stop it and start running the OS for a little bit. We also have a category which are synchronous, and these are triggered by the running program. So one example is our segmentation fault, that you ran an instruction where the processor didn't know what it should do, so it wants to ask the OS for some help. You ran an instruction that accessed memory that didn't make sense, so it's going to ask the OS, hey, what do you want me to do about this? And the OS can make a decision like killing the program and writing a new program. And there are some other things which work this way, like divide by zero, invalid instructions. We also have this other category, which are traps, or intentionally triggered exceptions, where we're not making a mistake, like accessing memory we're not supposed to, or dividing by zero. We have some instruction whose only purpose is to trigger an exception. And we'll talk about why we need to do that later. So first, we've seen our timer. And this is probably the primary reason why, when I write that infinite loop program, it doesn't stop you from using the machine. Because there's a timer device. Usually it's conceptually external, like you could imagine an external like timer that the processor controls by sending signals, but usually it's on the same chip. And the OS can configure this before starting to run a program, and it sends a signal to the CPU. The CPU reacts to that signal by triggering an exception and running the OS. And we also have I/O devices, which similarly can send a signal to the CPU saying, hey, I have something for you. And the way the CPU typically reacts to that is by running the OS with an exception. And in particular, so this gets us to how does I/O actually work in your programs? And at this point, we're going to need this other type, this intentional exception known as a system call. So let's talk about reading from the keyboard. I try to read something from the keyboard. I'm going to make an explicit exception to run the OS, known as a system call, to ask the OS to do something. Then I'm going to wait for the key press to happen, if it hasn't happened, and the OS is going to figure that out, and then decide to run me again with the result of my key press. So the way this looks is I have my program that reads input. It makes an explicit exception that starts running the operating system, known as a system call, saying, hey, I want to read from the keyboard OS. Make that work for me. So the OS starts running, and it realizes, oh, yeah, I need to wait for some keyboard input. So it runs some other program. It's waiting for keyboard input. It doesn't need to just sit there checking, is there keyboard input now? Is there keyboard input now? It's just going to run some other program. Because it knows that when the keyboard gets input, it's going to inform the processor of this, and the processor is going to start running the OS. And that informing the processor is known as an interrupt. And when the OS runs, it can make a decision about what does it want to do about the key press. And because I made this explicit request to the OS, hopefully its decision is, okay, I should run you, because you wanted to know about this key press. And that's what it does. Questions about this timeline here? So you can see, because we have exceptions, when we're doing things like waiting for input, the operating system doesn't have to hog the CPU to do that. It doesn't have to actually check. It just gets notified when it needs to do something. Yeah?
What's the difference between the yellow and the pink?
I'm saying, hypothetically, while I'm waiting for the key press, two other programs get run for a little bit. Could be more, could be less. But the OS can do lots of things while I'm waiting. Okay, other questions? Okay. And we mentioned our sort of last type of exception is faults. So let's talk a bit about, now that we've seen these types of exceptions, I'm glossing over aborts because they don't come up very much, but they are something you'll really see in processor manuals. Basically, hardware is broken. But we have all these different reasons for exception. So what actually is the hardware mechanism for implementing that? So basically, we need to detect that something bad happened. We need to save the current value of the program counter somewhere. And we need to jump to the exception handler. So this is basically, we detect something happened and we effectively insert a secret jump instruction. That's basically what we're doing, exception. So I'm going to show you sort of one way that we could set this up from the OS's point of view. This is going to be a bit simplified versus what, if you look up like what real x86 does, but not in any what I would think important details. So a common way for the operating system to tell the processor, well, you have to jump to the exception handler, the OS code that knows what to do, you have to say, where is that code? So one way we can do that is with a table where we'll have an entry for each kind of exception. And the OS will set this special register to point to this table. The processor will look up the entry in this table depending on the type of exception we'll have. So we'll have one entry for divide by zero, one entry for timer interrupts, one entry for the equivalent of segmentation faults, and so on. And the OS can have different code in each of the cases depending on what it does for each kind of exception. So the processor needs to use this special register and look up the appropriate entry in the table when it detects that an exception happens. And then it needs to save the old program counter somewhere. It needs to do that because, well, if we don't do that, how do I go back to the right place in my infinite loop program later on? I need to have that information remembered somewhere. So the processor needs to save it. One place it could save it is like a special register. Another place it could save it is like on into memory somewhere. But it needs to save it somewhere. Then the OS gets to run, and the OS can handle all the other work. It can save any other registers it needs to save somewhere in its memory, and so on. So, question? Yeah.
So that's one example of
these cases. So you're saying like this is the sorts of things that the handlers could do? Yeah. Exception handlers can end up being quite complicated. Most likely, if they're quite complicated, what actually happens is we have some assembly routine that then calls like something written in a higher level language like C. And so to implement this, we have just a few things added to our CPU. We have our set exception table base instruction, because that was a new register we added. Or maybe we could avoid adding that and just say it's at a specific memory location all the time, no matter what. We have this logic to do the jumping. We have some place to save the program counter. And also, it turns out we're going to have a new instruction typically to return from an exception. We'll talk about why we need a new instruction a bit later, but this certainly will make things easier because we don't have to worry about where do I store the location to return back to. This instruction can take care of that special logic. So one thing we'd like to talk about is, well, we talked about out of order execution, and this actually complicates dealing with this exception idea because our first step was we detect this condition and then just stop execution. And this logic I gave you sort of suggests that we're running one instruction at a time. But we know that's not how our processor works. We're writing a whole bunch of instructions and not in the program order. So we need to somehow deal with this and stop the program after a particular instruction, even though we may have started some other instructions. And this is what our reorder buffer is for. So we're going to need to figure out, OK, we had an exception here. I need to flush all the other instructions, move on. So the way we're going to implement that typically is we have our typical out-of-order processor, where we do some register renaming. And we have this mapping of what are our register numbers for new instructions. And I have a reorder buffer, which tracks my instructions that are being completed. And we know we're not completing the instructions in order, But as we start new instructions, we add it to the end of this reorder buffer. And in this reorder buffer, we keep track for each instruction, is it actually completed? And we're also going to keep track for each instruction, did this instruction cause an exception? We need to keep track of that because we might detect that the instruction caused an exception, you know, but it might be like down here. And if an instruction above it also caused an exception, the first one should be the one which causes us to stop. This is for synchronous instructions. For asynchronous ones, it doesn't matter which one we mark, really. We just need to mark something. So we're adding things to the bottom of this, executing them, and sometimes we discover there's an exception. And the way this is going to work is as we complete instructions, we're going to try to remove things from this reorder buffer in order. And as we're doing that, we need to keep track of what are our actual register values of completed instructions. And we need this because something we need to do that was pointed out is that when the OS runs, we need to know what are the actual values of the registers, not including things that we're not going to let complete. If we have an exception right here, I want the values of the registers at that instruction, not the values that include things that we're supposed to flush. So this is how we're implementing that flushing of not ignoring those future instructions. So as this instruction completes, I say it wrote T32, which is supposed to be RCX. So I update this mapping saying completed instructions. You know, for the instructions we've all done, that is the mapping of physical to architectural registers. That is where the current value of RCX is now in T32, if you need to look it up, for instructions we've actually finished completely and won't be suppressing. We've done what we call the write-back for it. And we're going to go down this reorder buffer, crossing out instructions as we update this information over here. And let's say we have an exception here, which trigger instruction here later on, which triggers an exception. So we're going to record that it has an exception, and we're going to do nothing until we get to it. And we're going to do nothing because, well, before we run the OS, we need to update RDX and RAX with their correct values, even though we haven't finished the instruction that produces RDX. So we're going to wait for that to finish first. So eventually those are going to finish, and we're going to cross them out, and then we're going to go down this reorder buffer trying to finish more and more instructions, update our mapping of what are the values of registers for things we've completely done. And I'm going to say, oh, there was an exception in this instruction. Oh, well. And to handle that, I'm going to just need to start running the OS. So at this point, I'm going to say, OK, I have an exception here. I can't actually run this or any of the future instructions. I'm just going to get rid of them. And I also want to forget about any of the register updates they did. You know, so even if like instruction 21 just finished writing to its register T6, I don't want to use that. So the way I'm going to handle that is I'm just going to copy my list of my mapping of the registers for completed instructions into my ones for new instructions, and then I'm going to start fetching instructions from the exception handler. So I've just reset all my registers to where they were when we got to this exception, and then I'm going to start running the OS code with those registers. Okay, so questions about this procedure? Yeah. So the question is, we have these pointers to these exception handling routines. Who wrote them? The answer is the operating system author writes them. And they make all the decisions about what it should do.
Do they get changed over time?
So the question is, Do these change? Yes. The operating system decides what's in the exception handler, and the operating system puts whatever is convenient for the operating system in the exception handlers. Other questions? Yeah. All modern operating systems implement. So this is hardware, not operating system, right? The operating system only knows about these architectural registers. So this is how the hardware is providing the illusion that we just stopped the program where the exception happened and started running the operating system. Even though we know under the hood that's not really the case, because we didn't run the program in order. Other questions? Okay. Worried that I didn't explain this well because I expected questions on that. Okay, so talked about the mechanism for, even though we run instructions out of order, how we make it appear in order. So we get to the state just when we've finished all the instructions up to the one where the exception happens. So we can start running the OS at the appropriate point. Then in the OS, we have an exception handler. And the exception handler, the OS gets to choose what's in it, but typically it has this structure. First, the first thing most OS's exception handlers always do is save the current state. Note that this isn't like a function call because the processor is probably not going to save very many registers. And unlike a function call, you might be in the middle of the program using RAX or RBX. You can't use those registers unless you save them or the processor has saved them for you. So you need to save a lot more than for a typical function call somewhere. You know, not just the call D, call or save doesn't work because it's not a normal function call. We're interrupting in the middle of something important. Then you, after you save that state, you do the work to handle the exception. So like if it's a system call asking to read from the keyboard, you set that up. If it's a timer interrupt, you start running, you figure out what other program you want to run. Then you restore some process's state, possibly a different process, possibly the same process. That's a decision the operating system gets to make however it wants to, whatever it thinks is most efficient. And then you jump back to the program. Okay, so questions? Okay, so that's basics of exceptions. So let's talk about our first use case for exceptions, which was this time slicing idea. That we were running our program, we had a timer interrupt, and the processor looked up in the exception table during that timer interrupt and started running this OS code, and inconveniently for me as the author of my infinite loop program, it stopped running my infinite loop and decided to switch to this other SSH program it thought was more important. It's really inconvenient. I'd like to fix that. So I have a proposed fix. You know, this exception table lookup, the problem here is that it's looking up this handle timer interrupt function. It's written all wrong. You know, it really should just return back to my infinite loop, keep running it. You know, that's really what I want to happen. So let's fix that. You know, let's make my own exception table with my own timer interrupt handler. You know, this great one, which just returns, seems great. You know, don't do any that running another program. We don't need that. And then I have my infinite loop. Okay. So this is, you know, my idea for a better infinite loop program, because my last one, I didn't get to actually hog the whole machine. Maybe this will do it. And, you know, I can run this. I can set this up. So here's an example just doing the first step. I'm just going to load a new timer interrupt handler. And it turns out the instruction to set the exception table base pointer in x86 is called LIDT for load interrupt descriptor table. So I can just run that instruction. I can write that instruction there and do it. And I run that. And I run this program, it compiles, it builds, and I run it, and I get a segmentation fault. Just trying to set the table. So what happened here? So what happened here is I did something I wasn't supposed to do, but the processor somehow knew I'm not supposed to be able to set the exception table, even though the OS could do it. And this is a type of fault. So go, or don't have my slide. So this is a type of fault known as a privileged instruction. So there are these instructions that we just can't let any program do. And one example is we can't just let any program set a new exception table, because that program could, like my evil loop program, decide I'm going to hog all the CPU forever by fixing the timer interrupt handler to not do anything. And there's some other things we don't want programs to do, especially if it's shared between users. Like, we don't want it to set the address space. You don't want it to be the case that I, writing on a live machine, can read the memory of your text editor and figure out what you're editing. We also don't typically let programs directly talk to things like hard drives, keyboards, and displays. For hard drives, we don't want you to read any file on the hard drive. We want you to ask the OS, is it okay if I read this file? And similar is true for other things. And the processor has support for this, whereby we don't let programs run certain instructions when we're in what's called user mode. So in user mode, the privileged instruction doesn't actually set the exception table. Instead, it just triggers an exception. And in the case of my infinite loop attempt, the exception it triggered just caused the OS to say, okay, you weren't supposed to do that, I'm going to kill you. Get rid of that program. No, don't need to run it. So there's two modes. There's a kernel mode, where the privileged instructions work, and a user mode, where they don't. And a kernel mode is intimately connected with exceptions. So to implement kernel mode, we're going to have an extra 1-bit register in our processor, which is already in kernel mode. So that's simple. And exceptions are going to enter kernel mode, and we have this special return from exception instruction. And one of the reasons we'll have it is it's going to let us leave kernel mode. So when we return from an exception to a user program, when we set that up, it's going to go to user mode, where all these special things won't work. When we go into an exception handler, all those will work. And because the operating system writes all the exception handlers, it can make sure it only does these privileged operations in ways that make sense for the operating system. So the operating system, by writing its exception handlers carefully, makes sure that only the right users can read files, that only the operating system gets to set the exception table to the place where it wants it to be set. At least that's the hope. Okay, so questions? This idea? And this gets us to why we needed a system call. So we learned that the normal program can't, like, talk to the keyboard directly. We need the operating system to run a privileged instruction to do that. So running, deliberately triggering an exception, is going to let the operating system do it because it enters kernel mode, where the operating system's exception handler can now do that for us, even though if we just directly called that code, it wouldn't work, because we wouldn't switch to kernel mode. We wouldn't trigger an exception. Okay. Yeah?
When you say enter the kernel mode and leave kernel mode, are you talking about the OS entering kernel mode or the program entering kernel mode?
So the question is, what's entering kernel mode? And the answer is the processor's entering kernel mode. Remember, we have this 1-bit register. So when I say entering kernel mode, I mean setting that register to 1. And when I say exiting kernel mode, I mean setting that register to zero. So this is just an additional single register value that's changed by our exception entry procedure. In addition to looking up in the exception table, we change this register, and by that return from exception instruction, in addition to figuring out what to set the PC to, we also change this register. Okay, other questions? Okay, so showed you why we can't do this code here, which just edits the exception table, changes the exception table. So one question you might have is, why can't we just edit the interrupt table? You know, it's in the OS's memory. It has to be, it's probably there. Why can't we just change it? And you might say, okay, well, you showed me this address space thing here earlier. You know, that probably explains it. And it kind of does, but there's a bit of an issue there, which is that, well, we have this OS data here, and when the OS is running, it needs to access its data. And I told you that we do change the address space as part of the context switch, which means, as far as we've known so far, it seems like we're in the same address space when we start running the exception handler, that this mapping hasn't changed. But that's a problem, because that sounds like I could edit the interrupt table, the exception handler table, and didn't matter that I couldn't change it to a new value. I can just change the entry in it to point to my function. So what's stopping me from doing that? And you might think the answer is that, you know, we change mappings on the exception table, and we kind of do, but it's a little different than that. So something you may have noticed when I showed you this picture of program memory is this region at the top labeled used by OS. And what is that? And the answer is that this mapping has a little more fidelity than what I showed you earlier. That in addition to marking things, you know, as triggering errors, I can have mappings to the OS data that are marked as kernel mode only. So like privileged instructions will trigger exceptions, if you try to use that part of the mapping from user mode, it won't work. It will trigger an exception, but when we try to use it from kernel mode, it will. And this way, the OS can keep itself in every program's memory in that top area of the memory and doesn't have to change this mapping all the time. That's another use for the kernel mode bit, is that we make the parts of the mapping conditional on it so the OS can have private data and not have to change the mapping to access it. Okay, so questions about this idea? Okay, and what we call for any case where you're trying to do a privileged operation is often called a protection fault. When you try to do any of these things, which you can't do because that kernel mode is not set, that you are in user mode, you are not running OS code that's supposed to do these extra operations. And the OS gets to decide what to do. In your experience, you're probably used to the OS saying, okay, we're going to crash the program now. So one last thing I mentioned, we have these system calls. So in system calls, we ask the OS to do something. So that means we run code in kernel mode deliberately. And processors typically have special instructions just to trigger exceptions for this purpose. So in 64-bit x86 on Linux, the instruction we use is syscall, and just runs an exception handler. And rather than the exception handler just saving the program state and like doing whatever it wants, it assumes that before you run it, you set things up in a particular way. So there's a calling convention for system calls. So before you make that syscall instruction, you set up registers in a particular way. And then when it returns from it, it's going to go to the next instruction, and it's going to put the return value of that kernel operation there. So it's kind of like a function call, but we don't can't actually specify an address of a function. Instead, we just put an operation number in RAX in Linux, and that's just a convention Linux chose. So code which does this might look something like this. Here I say one is the number for write, and I specify my parameters for write, write to standard out, write hello world, which is 15 bytes. Do that operation, please. And then I have this second operation, which is exit, that I asked to do. And that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we'll talk, finish up this and then start talking about virtual memory.